Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand.
I was willing to be a martyr for a cause. There's a cause in which I believe very strongly, which is a cause which involves tremendous injustice, which I saw, which I felt that I could do something to alleviate. It is a cause which, in biblical terms, almost I saw as a fight between evil and good, between light and darkness. And maybe I'm a bit self-righteous, but I strongly believe in the freedom of choice. I believe that women should have a right to own their bodies. I believe they should have a right to safe medical abortions when they need them. I think it's one of the great issues of our time, where indeed an enlightened philosophy which respects the dignity of the individual is sort of pitted against what I consider an ideology which is totalitarian, which is disrespectful of people's opinions and convictions, and which condemns so many women to danger of life and health and so on.
That was a clip from an interview with Dr. Henry Morgenthaler that aired on CBC's The National back in 1977. I'd wager most kids walking out of high school history classes in this country couldn't tell you who Morgenthaler was or what his contributions were to fighting for access to abortion in this country. And probably most of us as adults remain ignorant of this too. So maybe it's time for a refresher. Morgenthaler was a Polish Jew who emigrated to Canada after surviving the horrors of Auschwitz and Dachau. In Canada, during the 70s, he then went on to perform hundreds of illegal abortions, which eventually landed him in a Quebec prison for 10 months. This week, we have been hearing a lot about the prospect of Roe v. Wade being overturned by the Supreme Court in the United States, and the ripple effects that that move could have throughout that country. Well, in Canada, we don't have Roe or Wade. We have Morgenthaler. Canada's landmark legal decision for abortion access is known as R. v. Morgenthaler, a decision that made it clear that the government could not dictate how or where women accessed abortion services. And that decision came more than a decade after Roe v. Wade. This week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he's assigned two ministers to review the legal framework around abortion access in Canada to ensure, quote, that not just under this government, but under any future government, the rights of women are properly protected, end quote. Canada's Families and Social Development Minister, Carina Gould, said on Power in Politics that Canada would be accepting Americans who find it difficult or impossible to access abortion services in their home country.
I mean, I don't see why we would not. I mean, if people come here and need access, certainly, you know, that's a service that would be provided.
That abortion access is a necessary healthcare service is an issue that has largely been settled with most federal political parties in Canada, though debate still wages in the Conservative Party. Getting to this point was not easy, though. Many people fought long and hard for abortion access, and it's not exactly ancient history. Even as recently as 2016, advocates in PEI took their province to court to have the local abortion ban overturned. Today, we will talk about the fight that was waged to gain these rights and hear from some of the women who were on the front lines of that fight. They'll also talk about how easily they fear those hard-earned rights can be eroded. I'm Sarah Larniuk. I'm the senior producer of this show, and I'm sitting in for Jesse Brown this week. Christabel Sethna is a historian and professor who teaches at the Institute of Feminist and Gender Studies at the University of Ottawa. She joins me next. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Megan Edwards, Danielle Jones, Connor Simpson, Stephanie Skavinsky, Sean Gracie, David Gilmore, Tammy Tebert, and Ralph.
Hi, I'm Ralph. I live in Calgary, where I'm mostly retired, and I've been freeloading Canada Land for some time now. But eventually, Jesse will guilt you into kicking some coin his way in order to keep up the good work. And it is good work, and it's worth supporting. I will, however, miss hearing Jesse schlepping for his sponsors. But maybe he could devote a podcast exclusively to that. Jesse schleps for sponsors. That could work.
Hi, Professor Sethna. Thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Maybe we just start with your background because I find the area you study so interesting. You specifically study history of sex education, contraception, and abortion. How did you end up in that particular realm?
Oh my goodness, how much time do we have? Well, the whole area of reproduction fascinates me. I began with the history of sex education. And then I was lucky enough to do a postdoc specifically about a history of the birth control pill in Canada and its impact on young university-aged students. And at that time, we had this very strange situation in Canada when technically the birth control pill was available, even though contraception was illegal. But doctors could prescribe the birth control pill, and it was usually prescribed to married women, not single women. So single women were left in the lurch. I started coming across accounts of university-aged women who were writing about going to different cities, seeking out abortions through these underground networks, underground abortion providers in different locations in Canada. So I started becoming attuned to this idea of women traveling for abortion services. And then over time, I pursued this angle more vigorously and then received another series of grants to study women traveling nationally and internationally for abortion services.
Given your expansive knowledge about the history of access to abortion services, it might almost sound wild to you that like a lot of people don't even know the basics, but I wondered if you could take us back to the 60s. How did access to abortions even come about in Canada?
Abortion was illegal in Canada. And then in the 60s, we see a movement on the part of patients, politicians, lawyers, and significantly the medical profession to try and work with an abortion law or a number of abortion laws in Canada that were confusing and oftentimes contradictory. So the medical profession at the time raised concerns about the possibility that they would lose their professional status, They might be subjected to prison terms. So inevitably, a new government, this is the Liberal government, starts moving toward revision of the criminal code. And we see something called the Omnibus Bill. And the Omnibus Bill comes into play in 1969. So the sort of top three takeaways from the Omnibus Bill is that contraception is legalized and abortion is liberalized. Abortion remains within the criminal code and it's approved, it's legal, but under very restrictive conditions. And sometimes people also forget that at the same time, homosexual acts between consenting adults are now also legalized. So these are the big three.
There's obviously other landmarks that came down the road, but between 1969 when that happened and 1988 when the next significant step forward came, what was access like?
So this new abortion law that came into play in 1969 worked like this. It meant that a woman first had to get a referral from her family doctor. And of course, not all women had family doctors. The abortion could only be done in an accredited hospital. And not all hospitals were doing abortions. In that hospital, there had to be a therapeutic abortion committee. The therapeutic abortion committee was composed of about three, four, possibly five doctors. And the only guidance in the law said that the pregnancy could be legally terminated if it posed a threat to the life or the health of the woman. But the law never disclosed or defined what life or health meant. So it was up to the therapeutic abortion committees or individuals on those abortion committees to decide what the criteria for life or health meant. And women had to go forward to plead their case. So can you imagine the confusion and the length of time this would have taken? So very few women could go through this therapeutic abortion committee and come out the other side with a safe abortion in a timely fashion.
Well, and then one of the obvious people to bring up here is Henry Morgenthaler and the role he played. I wondered if you could explain a bit about how he was responsible for pushing boundaries at that time.
Well, Henry Morgenthaler is an absolutely fascinating figure. He was a Holocaust survivor. He eventually became a doctor with a practice in Montreal. And then he began providing women with abortions in a way that broke the 1969 law, because the 1969 law was very clear that a legal abortion could only be conducted in a hospital and in an accredited hospital. So by operating on women and providing them with abortions in his Montreal clinic, he was breaking the law because the woman was not going through these required legal steps. As a result of his work, he was arrested, he went to trial, he went to jail, and eventually these court cases made their way to the Supreme Court of Canada. In January 1988, the 1969 law was struck down, saying that it was unworkable in a decision that's known as R.V. Morgenthaler. So once this law was struck down, there was no federal law guiding abortion in the country. And this was a huge victory for Henry Morgenthaler and his supporters and the legions of feminist and pro-choice activists.
Revered as a hero by some, denounced as a murderer by others. One thing both sides can agree on, Morgenthaler changed the course of history in this country.
Ultimately, he opened clinics across the country wherever he felt women were at risk. And like clockwork, there were raids, protests, charges, and worse, violence.
My name is Deb Miller, and I'm a retired family lawyer, practiced family law for 40 years. I've always been active in the feminist circles, particularly in reproductive rights issues. And I graduated from law school in 1978, so the law hadn't even changed yet. So we were basically still in the situation where we were looking at case after case, usually involving Henry Morgenthaler, to fight to get the law changed, abolished, whatever. And so we became quite friendly with Henry Morgenthaler, who is, you know, was my personal hero. And our problem in Alberta was that, although it wasn't illegal, we had no access because there was a therapeutic abortion committee comprised of three men, usually, and they were 6 or 7 weeks behind. You had to get approved within 8 weeks. So anyway, as I'm fond of saying, you had to basically book your appointment with the therapeutic abortion committee before you even screwed anyone. So the access was the problem. And so one day we were just, our group was sitting around and somebody said, well, you know, our problem is access. So we walked across the street to my office and we actually phoned Henry Morgenthaler in Montreal and he answered. The law had already changed. It was after 1988 and he basically then was on a crusade to open up abortion clinics across the country. And we said, here's our problem. And he said, build it and I will come. And, you know, that was the start of it. We then had to work on finding doctors who would do abortions and somehow keeping this very secret from the other side. And it was a pretty exciting time. We got firebombed once, I think. The people, like our architect, got picketed at his home and he quit on us. And there was ups and downs. I remember talking to Henry and saying, oh, the architects quit. We'll never get this done. And he said, Debbie, you cannot give in to those zealots, which is that kind of guy. And so the day of the clinic opening was really, really exciting. I think you had every feminist in Edmonton involved. We used their spouses and partners to form a phalanx of people to get women into the clinic. So it was pretty darn exciting time.
Okay, so we have this period, late 80s and the 90s, where Henry Morgenthaler and other supporters are, you know, opening up as many clinics as they can across the country. But I guess I'm wondering if that really succeeded in solving the access problem from coast to coast.
Well, for some women, it worked very well because they were able to get an appointment and have an abortion. But other women are left out of the equation. Rural women, Indigenous women, women living in the north, poor women, young women, women from Eastern Canada, they're still having a hard time and it's difficult for them to get the funding to travel. So what ended up happening in the study that Dr. Marion Duell and I did is that we found that the younger the woman was and the poorer the woman was, the further she had to travel. So although the court in 1988 recognized that travel was a major burden for women to subsume, we see that same factor at play post-1988.
Some of your research really pointed out the disparity in access for people of lower socioeconomic standing, at the very least. 60% of women who responded made less than $30,000 a year, 23.8% made less than $10,000 per year, and 9.7% were receiving social assistance. What does that tell you about who's accessing abortion services?
Well, definitely it is marginalized women and younger women and poorer women. And what we can see from the statistics is that it could also be a function of their youth. So the younger a woman is, the more likely she is to be poor. These statistics also reflect regional disparities. It has got better but there are still pockets of women who are left out. And I want to point out, particularly for women from the North and Indigenous women, many of them have to come into the Southern cities for childbirth purposes, not just for abortions. And this kind of travel is already baked into medical systems in the northern regions of this country. So we have to think about abortion as one point in a larger framework of inequalities operating within the medical system in Canada. But we do tend to focus a lot on abortion. The broader picture is that it is part and parcel of inequalities that exist already in this country.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand.
My name is Colleen McQuarrie. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Prince Edward Island, and I've been an abortion activist for most of my reproductive life. In relation to abortion access in Canada, Prince Edward Island was unique for a number of decades in the sense that when the abortion ruling came in, the Morgan Tyler ruling in 1988, that was basically meant to allow better access across Canada. PEI doubled down and declares ours a province that would be free of abortion. And so for 30 years, we had a network here where we helped women to get off the island to access safer abortion services. In 2010, we undertook a community-based collaborative action research project documenting the harm that 30 years of an abortion ban had done to us and our communities. And so what was heart-wrenching even to us activists was just the deep level of emotional and physical harm. Every single participant in our project talked about how before they even tried to access local service, which they knew was non-existent, but they were hoping that they could somehow try to self-induce an abortion. We were overwhelmed with the reach of that project. Within 3 days, we had more than 600 shares in more than 11 nations, and we started to get a sense Sorry, I get emotional. We started to get a sense of the diaspora. And as a lead researcher and a person who grew up here and trying to start this project, a number of people had said, we're tired. We don't think that this will make any difference. And nobody's going to participate. And by the time they were coming back to the table, people had fallen silent for about a decade. And so this project was one of the first sort of steps on the path to reclaiming abortion access. And I think I got so emotional because I realized the impact that asking a simple question can have to starting and reigniting the empowerment of people who had been so hurt. The simple question was, what are the harms that have happened as a result of banning abortion in Prince Edward Island? And so to launch the question and 3 days later have more than 600 responses from more than 11 countries and have people say, thank you for finally asking this question. And they said, I had to leave PEI to get an abortion and I could never go back. Right. So the level of stigma and shame and harm that we endured here was phenomenal. The myth that we'd been told that, oh, sure, you just have to leave PEI to get an abortion, it's not that hard. The myth was that it was easy, but it was never easy. The indignity when you did get on public transit to get on a bus and bleeding after an abortion. And one woman talked about, you know, putting down a plastic bag on the public transit bus so that she wouldn't bleed all over the bus. And partway through the drive back to PEI, there's a stop where you can get off and go to the bathroom and get a coffee. And she talked about looking down and seeing the blood in the seat and thinking, how am I going to get out of this? Like, so she tied something around her waist so that the blood wouldn't be obvious to everybody. There's no dignity when you treat women so poorly. I just didn't know I would cry with you today. I have no idea what's going on. Like, I've given hundreds of interviews about this, and I've always had a level of, I guess, composure. But today, for some reason, it's hitting hard. You know, we wrote a book about it, so I can't give all the details, obviously. But at the end of the day, the politicians refused to look at the evidence, refused to repeal the ban on abortion. And we were able to, with the help of LEAF Canada, Legal Education Action Fund, we took the province to court and we served the papers in January of 2016. And at the end of the day, we won. I mean, the legal system in Canada is different from the legal system in the United States. But our experience here in Prince Edward Island was that this province decided it would thumb its nose at the Constitution. And since 1988 up until 2017, continued to thumb its nose at women's experiences, at people who needed abortions experiences. And continues to thumb its nose in some way because the access we were promised hasn't been completely delivered upon yet. And so I don't think politicians in Canada are any different from politicians in any other part of the world, to the extent that they think that it can be self-serving to sacrifice people's human rights. And so that is why I guess I get so emotional. What could they do to us here to remove our capacity to use Morgan Tyler? Because if we hadn't had that 1988 decision that basically said you can't prohibit access to abortion in clinics, and then subsequent governments have not weighed in, they haven't given us a federal law.
how does racial inequality fit in with that access and that need to travel?
Pregnancy, abortion, contraception, sterilization, they've all been shot through throughout history with inequality and particularly class and racial inequality. We know that historically the eugenics movement targeted, you know, the differently abled or the disabled, immigrants, indigenous, and poor. So these were the othered in our society. So we need to start paying attention to solving the problem of racial inequality and economic inequality alongside ensuring that abortion access is on the agenda for this country.
Yeah, it would be a real mistake to say that abortion is just about abortion, right? It's about one piece of a very large and complicated puzzle.
And there is also another factor that we are increasingly taking into consideration, and that is the needs of trans individuals, right? And the trans mm-hmm. population and their reproductive right. needs. And one of my PhD students is doing wonderful work on egg freezing and the kind of family formation. Trans health needs are different health mm-hmm. needs. And that's also becoming increasingly part of the framework of reproductive justice.
Okay, and the other landmark that I found astonishing took so long in Canada was the approval of, Mithigaimiso. Am I saying that right?
Even I have trouble saying this word, and this is why most people say
okay,
Miffy.
Miffy then. Anyway, the pill that essentially allows someone to gain access to an abortion through pills that you can pick up at a pharmacy. And Canada was the last industrialized country to approve this medication's use, and that didn't happen until 2015, whereas in the States it was approved in 2000. Do you have any insight about why that moved so slowly here?
I wish I could tell you. This is a research project in the making. We can assume that there was bureaucracy involved. When the 1988 law was struck down by the Supreme Court in Canada, we see a growth in anti-abortion activism. So that is a major player in what's happening in the 1990s and the 2000s. Another way of looking at it, the much more cynical way of looking at it, is that our history shows that the medical profession wants to maintain control over women's bodies. That is the cynical interpretation. And it is borne out historically.
I spoke with Colleen McQuarrie and a number of other women, and I heard kind of repeatedly, especially after the leaked decision came out, that they're just exhausted. Like, these women who have fought for this access are just exhausted. I wondered what you hear in your research from people who work in this area about, like, just like the, like, it just never ends, right? Like, you take this step forward and then, like, you end up fighting the same fight again, or you fight it somewhere else, or what do you hear from people?
Has there been progress? Absolutely, yes. On the other hand, is there backlash? Yes. I want to remind everyone that after the 1988 decision, anti-abortion activism increased to the point of targeted assassinations. Three doctors were shot at, not killed, but they were shot at. Morgenthaler was attacked by a man with a pair of garden shears in the United States. Doctors were shot and killed, and clinics were firebombed.
I did hear that from the woman who started the one in Edmonton. She said it was firebombed, and it's just like,
yes.
Wow, okay,
yes.
That's actually putting your life on the line to offer these services.
Exactly. So the triumphalism around the striking down of the 1988 abortion law in Canada has to be tempered with everything that happened next. And it is extremely foolish to believe, and I can say this as a historian who takes the long view, it is extremely foolish to believe that for every step forward, we don't take 10 steps backward. And part of the reason why we're seeing this inequality, because there's progress in some directions, but then a backward slide in others.
My name is Autumn Reinhardt Simpson, and I am the founder of the Alberta Abortion Access Network, where I train what are known as abortion doulas in common parlance. We're abortion support workers who help clients access reproductive health care and advocate for them. A lot of people don't realize it, but Canada has a lot of the same access problems back in my home country, the United States, where I first began this work. I think Canadians are very shocked by this leaked memo and this idea of Roe being undermined. However, in the States, for a lot of us that have been doing this work for a long time, we've been expecting this for about the last 20 years. Anytime you have something that is considered constitutionally protected or a Supreme Court affirmed right, a group that opposes it cannot just come out and try to erase that right. So what they do is they chip away at it very slowly. And so that's what happened is ever since Roe v. Wade was enshrined in 1973, there have been groups coming out and slowly chipping away at this access. So they introduced things like trap laws, mandatory waiting periods, all these things that would just make it harder for someone to access abortion care. And what I like to say to Canadians is that you really can't be too complacent about it, even up here. Even in Alberta here in about 2018, we had this private members bill that was meant to expand the conscience clause so that not only would they be protected from having to perform an abortion, but that the doctor who objected would not actually have to refer either, which we already know in practice is exactly what's happening. But it's another way to sort of take something that is considered an enshrined right and just make it impossible to access. Healthcare for women, for trans people, for non-binary people has never been a major concern of any government in this world. It's something that is really fought for, and we fight hard. It's not something we can take for granted like men can. So to think that, my friends back home will have this huge gap in the kind of health care that they can receive. And, the U.S. has already got the highest maternal death rate of any industrialized nation. And among Black women in particular, it's really stark. I think, especially back home, what we're seeing is a real backlash to modern ideas about gender, because it's not even just Roe v. Wade, right? Now you have laws in Florida and Texas where it's against the law to get gender-affirming health care for your child. I think that what we're seeing is a lot of anxiety about changing ideas about gender, changing ideas about race, all kinds of different things. And to think that, now we're going to attempt to force people into pregnancy and into those terrible outcomes is just, it's barbaric, it's horrible, it feels awful, but I like to think it's not the end.
You looked at not only the long thread of this history, but also like the global thread of this history in a book that you edited that takes into account the rollback of abortion laws, not only in the United States that this plays into, but also in Poland, in PEI. So I wondered if you could talk about what you're seeing in a more global sense. What is the long thread on abortion access globally?
Yes. Thank you for asking that question. It is impossible to talk about abortion access without speaking about it transnationally, because events that happen in one region or one country will end up directly or indirectly affecting abortion access in another region or country. And women's networks play a major role in connecting women seeking abortion services with abortion providers. So I believe that that is also going to come into play.
You talk about this network of women finding abortion access, but I mean, then there is also this global network of anti-abortion activism. And how does that levy off one another? Because we have plenty of documented cases of anti-abortion groups funding, I think exclusively conservative politicians at the provincial and at the federal level. So how does that get influenced by international events? And how are those international connections indicative of how that movement goes?
Just as pro-choice activists have international connections and in many cases funding, so too does the anti-abortion lobby. There is among the anti-abortion lobby a tendency now to disregard its earlier history of violence and promote itself as a lobby that is securing women's health and securing the health of the fetus. And one of the ways in which the anti-abortion lobby can work is by passing personhood laws or constructing other laws that imply in some way, like inheritance laws, for example, or violence against a woman who is pregnant, constructing laws in a certain way that will offer personhood protections to the fetus. We focus solely on the issue of abortion to our peril. We need to take into consideration that those who are anti-abortion are often against many other advancements. And one of those advancements is gay rights. So there is some speculation that I'm seeing already that if the U.S. Supreme Court does indeed strike down Roe versus Wade, then what's next?
Well, and maybe even to make it specific, I mean, I reported from Poland, and Poland has obviously had a lot of rollbacks of abortion access, and also at the same time, access or safety even of LGBTQ people is very much in question. They'd spread during the last election campaign stickers in a right-wing magazine that said, like, no gay people are allowed here, and you could put these stickers up in your store and in your house and stuff. So, like, the line there was very clear, and I wondered, is that something commonly seen, like that those two are tied?
Poland is actually a fascinating example of backsliding in an era in which Poland supposedly became a democratic country. After 1989, when you saw the fall of the Berlin Wall, one of the very first things that the new Polish government puts on the table is restricting abortion. So one of my sort of pet theories is that the rise of the sort of the strong man who rules a country, somebody like Donald Trump or Viktor Orban in Hungary, what's happening in Poland right now, in the Philippines as well, in Belarus and Putin, this is happening in many parts of the world, that when we see this strong man kind of government, we're seeing a machismo, toxic masculinity at work at the highest levels of governments. It's a fascistic kind of government that ensures a very clear divide between men and women and the roles of men and women. So something like abortion and LGBTQ rights would not be tolerated in this kind of society because abortion means a rejection of maternity. And maternity is often seen as the foundational piece for a woman. And heterosexuality is a foundational piece.
Right, it threatens everything that they've built that way.
Yes, it threatens the foundation of the society that they want to create. And then mix into the situation the role of Christianity, whether it's evangelical Christianity or whether it's Christian fundamentalism or very strong Catholic focus This is all fueling this strongman framework.
My last question is, we started off by talking about Henry Morgenthaler. We heard from different abortion activists throughout the episode. What is the importance of remembering and understanding the history of abortion access now?
To me, the lesson is very simple. The lesson is access to abortion can be taken away. It can disappear. It can be made more difficult. And so we have to pay attention to these stealth moves that threaten abortion services. And we also have to improve access to abortion services within a reproductive justice framework.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. That's your Canada Land. Jesse will be back next week. You can email him about this or any other content Canada Land produces. He's at jesse@canadaland.com. You can also email me. I'm at sarah@canadaland.com. You can find us on Twitter @CanadaLand, and our website is canadaland.com. This episode was produced with the help of Cherise Sucharan and Cassidy Villabrun-Burakis. Tristan Capicione is our audio editor and technical producer. I'm Sarah Larniuk, the senior producer. Kieran Outshorn is our managing editor. Music is by So Called, and syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, please support us by going to canadaland.com/join or just clicking on the link in your show notes.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.